The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Europod. What's going on at Barcelona? The title slipping away, no Champions League for 5 years. Not many years left for Lionel Messi. How do we see him ending his career? Meanwhile, it's 5 goals in 7 games for Sergio Ramos since the restart. Is he really Real's key man? Ronaldo finally scores a free kick for Juve as they ease their way towards the title. Another trophy for Bayern and survival for Werder Bremen in Germany. Plus, we'll get some Jose stories from the continent after his 200th Premier League win. And boy, what a game it was. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the pod today, Barry Glendening. Hi, Baz.
Hey, Max. How are you?
I'm tremendous. It's lovely to see your face yet again.
Yes. You're looking on my Zoom window particularly unkempt today. You really need a haircut.
Yes, tonight. Tonight's the night.
And you seem to have just climbed out of bed. You're wearing like a, what would you call it, orangey, peachy t-shirt matching trousers.
It's a Washington Nationals t-shirt, and they are a baseball team, I think. And I picked it up from like a secondhand store in Washington and then walked past somebody in a B&B in Namibia who was like, "Hey, go Nationals!" And I looked at him like he was completely mad until I realized exactly what t-shirt I'd bought.
This reminds me of the time your kind of nemesis, Tim Lovejoy, was wearing a Ramones t-shirt on some chat show and was asked to name a Ramones album and couldn't. So I'm going to ask you, Max, who's your favourite Washington Nationals shortstop?
Oh, Babe Ruth. He was an absolute... he was mean at that position. Sid Lowe, how are you?
Right, thanks. How are you, Max?
Yeah, very good. There's lots of football happening at lots of different times. Are you managing to catch all of it?
No, I mean, the terrible tragedy is that I ducked out of Monday night's games and missed probably the greatest moment of the season.
We should introduce Nicky Bandini while we're all saying hello before we get into conversation. Hey, Nicky.
Hi, how are you?
Sid, you were talking about the greatest moment, perhaps, of the La Liga season.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of got the two best things that happen in football, which are, of course, a goalkeeper going up front and a striker going in goal. And it has these two things happening in the 101st minute. So you've got Lucas Ocampos, who scores a goal, Sevilla winning 1-0 against Eibar. The game goes into 101st minute, which actually is not quite as unusual as it sounds these days, because, of course, with the 5 subs, with the water break and all the rest of it. And in the 101st minute, Ocampos, who's been forced to go in goal because Vasilic has gone off for Sevilla, is the striker in goal. There's a corner. Eibar send their goalkeeper up. Dimitrovic is in the area. He gets the shot off and Ocampos saves it. So you've got the two guys in the same play, both fulfilling the greatest things that can happen in football. And then that led, I noticed someone asked this on Twitter last night, and I apologise, and it drives me mad when I've read something really cool that someone says on Twitter, and I can't remember who it is. It feels very unfair on them. But someone asked this on Twitter last night. Statistically, would this have been the first time ever that two players were on the pitch in a game in which they both scored against each other, had the shot gone in?
Oh, that's a great question.
So Ocampos has scored, and then Dimitrovic is up the other end and is going to score. But Ocampos saves it.
Someone will know the answer, I guess. Can we start then officially with Barcelona, Sid? You wrote a really good piece about their demise last week. Does a messy back heel to Griezmann and a delightful chip mean the demise is over?
No, I mean, look, this is one of the things that I've been trying to kind of, I've sort of been struggling with a little bit over the season generally, and in particular this weekend, because Barcelona were brilliant against Villarreal and won 4-1, but are still 4 points off Real Madrid at the top. Real Madrid were not brilliant, but won 1-0. And yet at the same time, this is why I struggle with it, because it doesn't entirely make sense. Real Madrid are going to win the league, and they're much more impressive in the sense that it feels like they're going to win all the time. It feels like you can rely on them all the time. And yet the reality is you watch their games, you think, well, they're sort of not that good. They've had moments. They were very, very good in the second half against Valencia. They were good against Eibar. But since the return of football, they've won 7 out of 7. They have never trailed. They've never been behind in that time. I think they've kept 4 clean sheets. I think it's 3 1-0s in a row now. And you look at them and you have this thing where you say, look, when they're good, Barcelona are probably still better. And in fact, Barcelona, you watch their games and you possibly see more things from them, but you see a vulnerability that just makes you think, oh, well, this will fall apart. And you watch Real Madrid and you sort of don't see necessarily all those things. But at the same time, you kind of trust them to get away, find a way through. You know, whether it's a penalty, a moment's inspiration, a ball that drops, a set play, whatever it may be. And I came up with this theory yesterday, which was a kind of a tentative one, but people seem to have quite liked it. So I'm prepared to go slightly further with it than I probably was 2 days ago, which is that once we've come back from lockdown and the league has been turned, what's been the longest league season ever has now become the shortest. The league's been turned into kind of a 10-game sprint. And it's a bit like a Champions League now. It's like, right, no time to think about it, no time to mess around, no time to make up for your mistakes. Just go and win and get through every game. And however you do it, don't care how. And whether that's lucky, because sometimes it's lucky, whether it's referees, because sometimes it's referees, whether it's a moment's inspiration, whether it's a penalty, whether it's whatever it is, you're sort of watching this and watching a little bit what happened with Madrid in those three Champions League successes in a row. And you sort of think, I'm not sure if they're brilliant or not, but somehow I kind of am sure that they're going to get through this and they're going to find a way every time.
So does that mean you're not sure if Barcelona aren't as good? They're just not as good in this situation.
So well, exactly. That's the thing. No. I'm sure that Barcelona aren't as good because, of course, this is the other thing in this, and this is where I slightly ruin my own theory. For this sort of 10-11 game sprint to happen, this kind of mini tournament, compressed into 6 weeks, which is what we've got. That to have even happened, of course, as a head-to-head sprint, the starting points had to be the same. Right, so they came back from the break, and Barcelona were only 2 points clear. So starting points were more or less level. In other words, consider it qualifying in a Formula One. Right, they had to be on the grid together and close to each other on the grid. Of course, in the last two seasons, by this point, by March, they'd have come back, and Barcelona would be starting 12 points clear. So this kind of Madrid's ability to kind of focus or to whatever it is to somehow get through would have been irrelevant because they'd have had too much ground to catch up. So this is a broader thing. It is about the whole season because, of course, Madrid had the better Clásico record. They won one of them and drew one of them. They were better than Barcelona in the second Clásico that they won. The first Clásico was dull, but it was fairly even. It's more that I kind of... You see things with Barcelona, but at the same time, you see this incredible vulnerability that makes you think, I just don't trust them. And yet you see less with Madrid, but you sort of watch them and think, yeah, I do trust them. I do trust them to find a way through. And maybe that's just because... I don't know. I mean, it's obviously not based on anything really objective. Some of it's objective, but not all of it. Some of it is just you watch them and think, I don't really know how, but they're going to get through here.
Is there a bigger picture about Barcelona in a sort of last dance type way that you've got, you know, Piqué, Suarez, Messi, Vidal, 33, Rakitic is 32, Alba and Busquets are 31, that almost someone has to sit down either this summer, maybe this summer, and say, right, it's the last dance, go and do it one more, come on, win La Liga, win the Champions League, and then you'll all go away. Or someone has to be really brave and say, we need to change a lot of this.
Yeah, I mean, look, and apologies, because actually what you've done is take me back to the question you originally asked me, which I didn't really answer because I went off on something else.
That's okay. I was still engaged in what you were talking about.
But you're right. And of course, this is the other thing. So you asked directly about the fact that Barcelona played brilliantly at the weekend and Messi dropped off a really lovely assist for Suarez and another really lovely assist for Griezmann, and they both scored and it worked really well. And there has been a sense of people saying, oh, green shoots, there's something here. But of course, there's something here with four games to go in a league title they're not going to win. And Setien said it right at the weekend. He said, this is a performance we could have done with before. Now, of course, what we're sort of forgetting is there's still a Champions League to come. And that's going to be another weird competition, of course, by the way, because it's going to be, all right, they've got to play the second leg of their last 16 games, but then they've got a quarterfinal, a semi-final, and a final in a 10-day period. So God knows what happens there. If they do get it right, they only need to get it right twice and then maybe fluke the other one. And they're going to be Champions League winners. But of course, that's going to be applicable to all the teams in it. And I don't know what Nicky thinks, but for example, I look at this now and think, actually, is this the best chance Atalanta are ever going to have? Because they're suddenly in this three-game tournament. And on a single night, if they get it right, they're going to blow teams apart, even really good ones. They have structural problems and they have an age problem. There's no doubt about that. And they do have to deal with this. But they still have really good players who, yeah, on their day are going to be fantastic.
I'm one of the last people, I think, in the world to have watched that. I finished it about 3 days ago and therefore sort of have fresh in my mind this narrative of Michael Jordan taking everything personal. Like everything that happens, it's like, oh, you know, and then I took it personal. I scored 100 points the next game. And I think that that same sort of mindset, sorry to bring it to this player, because I know this always happens with Messi, but that mindset of like someone said something and I'm mad and I'm going to show them. I feel like I definitely see that in Ronaldo and how he acts sometimes. Does Messi have that same sort of trigger? I mean, that's not about how good they are. It's just like, do you think he is activated by criticism in the same way?
I think Messi is, and obviously, look, in terms of the personalities, he doesn't externalize like Ronaldo does. So we don't get as clear a view of it. But one of the things that has definitely happened a lot of times over the years, and there's the one that really sticks in my mind, is there's a game, and I think it's away at Sevilla, where he scores a goal with a piece of blood-covered gauze still wedged in his mouth because someone's elbowed him. And that was one of those moments, and we've seen lots of these, that when someone fouls him or pisses him off on the pitch, you sometimes get this kind of 15 or 20-minute absolute whirlwind where there's a clear sign of this is an angry man. And so I don't know if we've necessarily seen it through criticism, but we've certainly seen it through moments on that kind of flashes on the pitch of what appear to be anger. Now, obviously, on the face of it, you could, just because they're so different, it kind of feels like not, because, of course, Ronaldo is so big. He's so kind of muscular. It's so physical and it's so kind of externalized. Whereas with Messi, because he's a technical player and it's a different type of... But I think we definitely see the anger with him. And obviously, we've seen in the way that he's responded to Barcelona, their board of directors, that he is very, very keenly aware of the accusations, for example, that he runs the club, the accusations, for example, that he can be a problem. And there's absolutely no doubt that that pisses him off. No doubt at all. Whether that translates into performances, I'm not quite as sure.
And Sid, just to flog this Last Dance comparison to within an inch of its life, Real Madrid seem to be getting a lot of, let's say, refereeing decisions going their way, and Barcelona in particular have raised this issue that, you know, they're playing against 12 men, basically, or up against 12 men in this race for the title because the refs are clearly on Real Madrid's side. Is there any foundation to their complaints, or is it just petty grumbling?
I mean, there's foundation up to a point. And obviously, there is, if the accusation is that there's some kind of conspiracy or that referees are on their side, then I think there is no foundation. There is foundation seen, I think, from a Barcelona perspective, given the frustrations and given the repetitiveness of decisions going Real Madrid's way since the restart. And there have been three or four really big ones. Away at Real Sociedad, there were three big decisions. There was an offside against Rodrigo against Valencia. There was a penalty against Getafe. There was a penalty this weekend against Athletic Bilbao, given for Real Madrid, and one in the other area, potentially not given for Athletic. But of course, I think, and well, this is one of the things that I love about, well, I love, it drives me mad actually, but you know, sort of, I love it in that kind of, God, this is this really still happening way, is that what sometimes happens, I think, is that you get a decision and people go, the decision's going Real Madrid's way. Yes, they have been, in that there is this run of decisions going Real Madrid's way. But the difference between the decisions going their way and the decisions being wrong. But so often the arguments are presented as, oh, look, here's seven decisions and they've all gone Real Madrid's way. I mean, I'm saying seven off the top of my head, by the way. I don't know if it's seven or eight or three or five or whatever. But there's seven decisions going Real Madrid's way. Yeah, okay. How many of them are wrong? And that's that's the problem with this. So, for example, you say the Athletic Bilbao game, well, that is a penalty. The Getafe game, well, yeah, that is a penalty. The Rodrigo offside goal, I mean, it's one of those ridiculously tight ones that's VAR. And I must admit, as a kind of an emotional reaction, I kind of think, oh, are we seriously ruling things out for that? But that's the rules and it's offside. The one where I have the doubts is the really big one was the one away at Real Sociedad, in which there's three decisions that go Real Madrid's way. But I think one of them's right. One of them might be right, and only one of them is wrong, in my opinion. Now, obviously, you get someone else who'll have a different opinion, but I think this is one of the problems, is that if you like, the cumulative effect of it is to have people say, oh, something's happening. But that actually, if you take them one by one, which is the way, of course, you're supposed to take refereeing decisions, there's not so many bad ones in there. And of course, there are bad ones that go both ways as well. But I can understand from an emotional point of view why Barcelona and their president came out and said this, why Barcelona would look at this and think, oh, hang on, you know, this is starting to, you know, the repetitiveness of it is starting to really, really kind of make an impact. That said, of course, the reason that Barcelona are in this position more than anything else is their own kind of institutional shitstorm.
I imagine there have been pages and pages written and hours of broadcasting time about what to do about Lionel Messi when Lionel Messi stops and how many years he has left. But you wrote in your piece that there's a deference to him that dominates everything and is not without problems, and it will take a brave man to broach. Soon, though, someone must. How? Who? And then I wrote how again. I just don't understand how you possibly do that.
I mean, look, I've said this lots of times, and it is an awkward one, which is one of the reasons why I say it takes a brave man. I think it takes clear thought as well. Quite a lot of the time, Barcelona's plan, and you know, this is simplifying for the sake of the argument, because there is more to it than this. Quite a lot of the time, Barcelona's plan is give the ball to that little guy wearing number 10. Right now, obviously, on the face of it, give the ball to possibly the best player that ever lived. It's quite a good plan, but I don't actually think it is a good plan, and I don't even think it's a good plan for him. Because, of course, it's give the ball to him while the other team can put... We've all seen these photos, which obviously sometimes get exaggerated, of Messi with five players around him and no one else on the pitch, because the photo is taken in such a way to isolate it and exaggerate this image. But, of course, there is something in that. You know, the best player in the world, if you put five players around, well, that tells you that there's someone free. But if that person who's free doesn't get the ball, because the mentality is always give it to Messi, give it to Messi, give it to Messi. And so often you see people not shoot when they could, or not play a different pass when they could, because they're giving it to Messi. And I know a lot of people dislike him for a lot of reasons, and some of those reasons are right. But this is one of the reasons why I still think, no matter what else, I think it's mad how often we overlook how brilliant Neymar was and how good Neymar was for Messi. Because he spread the pitch out, he opened space physically by going wide, and so the pitch, you know, becomes broader in terms of the space that's occupied. And also because he was prepared to go and do it. He wasn't going to just say, give it to Messi, give it to Messi. He was prepared to go and do it. And that was good for Messi. So what on the face of it is, oh, I'm not getting as much of the ball, is a good thing at times. And I think one of the things that made Neymar and Suarez important partners for Messi in that front three was that they were prepared to take on the responsibility. They had, Neymar at least, had enough of the cockiness to play. And that was good for Messi. And other players kind of haven't always had it. And then obviously the other thing is that, you know, those three won the European Cup 5 years ago. 5 years is quite a long time in football. And so you know, they're in, Neymar, of course, has gone. Suarez is in very different physical shape to what he was then. Messi is obviously different. What surrounds him is different. And so at times I sort of look at this and think, I think it's a legitimate question to ask what the impact of Messi is. But I think it's a much more legitimate question, the one that Messi probably asked himself, which is to look around and think, what the bloody hell have I done to deserve this?
And so do you think Messi appreciated Neymar as much as perhaps he should have, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely he did. I mean, look, to give you the best possible example of that, in the summer in which Neymar was on the verge of going, Barcelona were on pre-season tour when this happened. So it's not like this happened when everyone was away. So Barcelona were on pre-season tour, Neymar was there. If you watch, I think it's the last game Neymar plays for Barcelona in pre-season, Messi spends the entire game giving Neymar the ball in goal-scoring positions. There seems to be this attempt to say, listen, don't worry, I'm going to make you good. Stay here. I'll make you a Ballon d'Or winner. You know, stay here. I'll make you good. I'll do what it takes to keep you here. And the other great sort of, if you like, part of the answer to that question, the way of illustrating it is that ever since Neymar's left, Messi, more than anyone, has been the one making an effort to try and get him back again. And it is laughable that Barcelona found themselves in a position that the only replacement they've been able to find for Neymar is Neymar himself. And they've kind of desperately tried to get him back. But of course, they can't, because they've wasted all the money they got for him.
And in contrast, then, there's talk that Messi and Antoine Griezmann don't get on. But the goal celebration over the weekend would suggest they get on reasonably okay. Well, can you shed any light on that relationship?
Yeah, so they get on fine in the sense that, you know, there's no kind of overt problem, there's no confrontation. In fact, there's been some attempts to bring them together, so dinners together, even families meeting, and so on. And in particular, when Griezmann first arrived, Suarez in particular was kind of I know the phrase in Spanish, can't think what it is in English, trying to kind of build bridges to him and say, you know, trying to help him integrate and so on. And so there was an attempt, but it's not as kind of naturally warm as it was with Neymar, because they're different kinds of personalities. And I do genuinely think that there's an element of that, and there are bits where it hasn't had the same warmth. And of course, Griezmann knows that Messi and Suarez were agitating to bring Neymar back. And of course, when you're the guy going in to take that position, that can't feel particularly nice. that, you know, hang on, here I am to be the third striker. And these two guys, even knowing I'm coming, are saying to the club, bring Neymar back, bring Neymar back. And you know, they're on WhatsApp with Neymar saying, come back, mate. We'll try and make this happen. But actually, I think their relationship is perfectly good. It is genuinely reasonably good. I think on the pitch, I do think that, you know, there is a mechanical problem on the pitch. And I don't want to reduce it to the most basic thing of all, but there's a bit of me that does want to reduce it to the most basic thing of all, which is that Griezmann joins Barcelona after 5 years at Atletico when he's brilliant. And at Atletico Madrid, he's basically brilliant in two positions. Right-hand side, coming into the middle as an attacking player, or just off the other striker, sort of a number 10 position. In other words, the two positions in which Griezmann is brilliant, he goes to possibly the only club in the world where there's one man who's better than him. And so you've got a mechanics problem or a spatial problem, whatever you want to call it. And obviously what was interesting about the Villarreal game was that they played a formation where they played all three of them inside. So they played Suarez and Griezmann with Messi just behind. Messi in a kind of a much more orthodox number 10 position, sometimes swapping with Griezmann. So sometimes Messi was up with Suarez and Griezmann was behind him. And it worked. My doubt is whether this can work in lots of games because, you know, Villarreal gave them the space to play. They're not a particularly aggressive team. Defensively, they're not the strongest and so on. So I think there's a mechanics question as much as a personal one. But it is true that that kind of natural warmth that there was with Neymar, Suarez and Messi is possibly not there.
I want to ask this about the future of Messi because I'm fascinated to know what you think should happen. Like, I can't imagine him not playing for Barcelona. I sort of think they should preserve him in Aspic or something. You know, like, I can't imagine him going on to be a football manager. I can't imagine him doing anything but just running around playing for Barcelona. But it can't go on forever. But it's...
Give me an idea there, Max. I remember interviewing Bartomeu about a year. In fact, it was almost exactly a year ago. It was just after they'd beaten Liverpool in the first leg of the Champions League semi-final. And this is the thing to remember, by the way. Last year, they really should have won the treble. You know, having beaten Liverpool in that first leg of that semi-final, they were on course. And that morning, the following morning to that game, interviewing just Mario Bartomeu, the president, and him saying, "We're planning to build a statue of Messi." As you've just said, this is what they should do. They should do the Han Solo thing. And they, after his last game at Barcelona, they shouldn't build a statue of him. They should put him out there. They should freeze him in carbonite and put him outside the Camp Nou, and that's it. No more.
Yeah.
It does feel kind of wrong him going anywhere. He said lots of times that he wants to finish his career at Barcelona. We now know that he's put any contract renewal on hold, but I think that's about politics, and I think it's about this president rather than about a desire to leave necessarily. Obviously, he's going to be 34 this time next year. When his contract comes to an end. So that's a natural age at which maybe you draw a line under things. You know, that kind of romantic idea that he'll go to Newell's one day, I suspect won't ever happen. I think there is there's definitely the offer, whether or not he'll take it, to go to the US when his, if you like, his European career ends. But there's a bit of me that's like you that sort of thinks, you know what, when it ends, end it and end it there.
Yeah, I just don't want him to be a balding assistant manager of... Osasuna or something, you know, like that just feels totally wrong. We should talk about Sergio Ramos. 5 goals in 7 games. How talismanic is he? And has his role changed at all in that position since Ronaldo left?
You mean in the position of being a talisman?
Yeah. Not like being a goal scoring centre forward.
Well,
no.
Well, in a way, it sort of has because, yeah, of course, he's now taking the penalties. Which is why he's got 10 goals this season, which is his best goal-scoring season ever. It's why he's not just Real Madrid's top scorer. He's the top scorer in Spain since the restart. Now, admittedly, that's because it's a brilliant free kick in there. I think of the 5 goals, I think it's a free kick, 3 penalties and an open play goal, I think. Although, you know, this kind of swirl of games means I have no idea what day it is, let alone what's happened in the matches. I think it has changed him like that. I think it has given him greater leadership, although he always had it. But I think it's now totally unchallenged. You know, it's totally about him. And I was writing this yesterday and I realised that I'm kind of coming up with theories that sort of mean nothing. But I think Ramos sort of fits this idea that I had, that now that the league has become like a Champions League, he steps forward. Because Ramos, and this is obviously, by the way, this is something you can point the finger at him, accuse him for, as well as something you can celebrate him for, which is Ramos is that player that quite often in the autumn and around Christmas is awful. Like, genuinely, really not very good at all. And then somehow, when you get into March and April and May and those big Champions League games come around, somehow there's something about him. It's like, okay, now's my time. And it kind of feels like that this reinforces this idea that you know, this theory that I invented in my own mind of now is like a Champions League, because he is that sort of gone, oh, okay, it's here now. When the target is within sight, you know, when it's not just, oh, there's 38 of these games and we can sort of toss a few of them off and not worry about them. But it's right there, right? We get through this. And you see the seriousness of Ramos and the sort of the diving in and the epic and that taste for the this is the moment, that taste for, right, this is the big stage, now it's mine. But also there's a much more basic thing, which is those penalties, right? So he's now taking the penalties for Real Madrid. And he started taking them after Ronaldo left. So on the face of it, you can say, well, this is indulgent. You know, Ramos has gone. Ronaldo is gone. And Ramos has gone, right, I'll have these now. Thanks very much. I quite fancy a goal. And by the way, this is Ramos, who after the 2010 World Cup, in an interview with a TV show here in Spain, you know, everyone's talking about how wonderful it is that Spain won the World Cup. And he said, I must admit, I went back to Spain. I had a real thorn in my side at the fact I hadn't scored. He said, mate, you're a right back. You know, just won the World Cup. But there is that kind of, if you like, that desire to be showy, you know, that desire to be the centre stage. And so when he starts taking the penalties after Ronaldo's gone, to start with at least, you can sort of think, it's a bit self-indulgent. You know, this is a bit saying, right, my turn, come on, give it to me. And yet there is also another element to this, which is he then starts working at them. He takes a lot of Panenkas, but he scores them all. When he scored at the weekend, it was his 22nd consecutive penalty that he'd scored. So this isn't, it no longer seems, you know, indulgent. It now seems like just a intelligence.
Right. Well, listen, while we're on set pieces, we'll talk Ronaldo and set pieces, and we'll do that at the start of part two. Part two of the Guardian Football Weekly Tuesday edition Europod. Nicky, Ronaldo scored his first free kick for Juve. First in 43 attempts. I mean, it was a lovely free kick, wasn't it? You wonder, is there anyone at Juve who might, after maybe 25, go, do you know what, can I have one go?
Yeah, do you know what, it's great actually, because like there's been sort of several interviews, I feel like, maybe even like increasing in number in recent months with Miralem Pjanic, where he's like, oh, I've had a chat with Ronaldo and he said he's going to let me take a couple more, and then it doesn't happen. And actually, I remember I spoke to Pjanic right before Ronaldo arrived, and he was like, oh, it's not a problem, you know, like we're going to share it, it's going to be all split. And he even said, like, you know, I know my area, I know like where I'm most affected from, which is actually true. Like the Pjanic, you can see like the area he's most affected from are those ones quite close to the edge of the box, and especially sort of on the left hand side. But yeah, those haven't happened. Ronaldo has been spectacularly consistent up till now in not hitting the target. It was, as you say, a very good free kick. Juventus are flying at the moment.
His teammates look genuinely pleased for him. You know, like Arsenal teammates when John Jensen scored finally. Like it didn't look like they were like, you know, they look like they like him.
Yeah, I don't think at Juventus that Ronaldo is treated as some foreign object separate to everyone. Of course, in some ways he is. You know, he does live, even compared to someone very famous like Gigi Buffon, he does live a life apart from most footballers, but he isn't treated like that by the squad entering. I thought there was this very telling moment, actually going right back to the first day he arrived, which I thought was really significant, because on the first day that Ronaldo got to Juventus, there was all this media coverage. They talked about him like he was literally an alien. That was how he was presented on the front cover of the papers. And he's doing this sort of day at the training base. He's walking through, and he looks like an alien, you know? He looks like this sort of glowing stranger who's walked in. Everyone looks a bit scared of him, frankly. Even like the directors are also standing off him a bit. And he comes around a corridor, and it's all being filmed. He comes around a corridor, and Giorgio Chiellini walks in at the other end of the corridor, and Chiellini just goes up to him and gives him this massive bear hug. And I think that was like a really sort of, I don't know, it felt like this moment of humanizing this this sort of creature that had been brought in, this superstar. Like Chiellini just wasn't fazed like anyone else was. Chiellini was like, oh, come on, you know, you're part of the gang. And I think that there are players like that. Obviously, Buffon's come back, and I think he's like that with people as well. There's a few players like that at Juventus who are sufficiently strong in their own characters that Ronaldo wouldn't have been allowed to be separate. You know, he was always going to get sort of pulled into the family, for want of a better word.
I suppose there's a wider point in, you know, just because you're the best footballer or the most famous footballer or whatever in a squad, it doesn't necessarily mean you're the loudest or, you know, in the dressing room, like off the pitch, it's a totally different environment, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, like in terms of him and his behaviour, I think it's been sort of telling. Obviously, we're in a very particular phase right now with all these extra games being played, but there was this sort of situation early in Maurizio Sarri's tenure, I think it was against Milan, where he took off Ronaldo and Ronaldo looked huffy about it. And there was all this sort of question of, oh, you know, can you control a player like this? Can you, is Sarri strong enough to manage a player like this? And in this period now, when they're playing every 3 days, he's taken Ronaldo off and Ronaldo's sort of been all smiles and hugs and high fives and everything. So I think that sort of spirit is very much in the right place at Juventus at the moment. And obviously the results are bearing them out. They've won every game comfortably since the restart. I was just saying to Sid while we had a little pause, they have had very easy games since the restart. And in fact, the first one that's going to be a big challenge comes up tonight. So by the time that people listen to this, maybe things will have changed. They're playing Milan tonight and Milan playing really well all of a sudden. So yeah, they're rolling at the moment, which also has to do, by the way, with Paolo Dybala, who I'll talk about in a second, but I know Sid wants to go with the question.
Yeah, it was more just to kind of pick up on that idea of Ronaldo taking a rest. When Real Madrid won the second of the second league title with Zidane, the first league title with Zidane, but in that 3 year run of Champions League, and it was in the second season, they won the league as well. In the last 8 weeks of the season, I think it was, Ronaldo didn't even travel to any of the away games. And Zidane had basically had a conversation with him earlier in the season, says, look, you're not going to play as much. It's true, you're going to miss out on some goals. You're not going to be able to beat up on the smaller scenes, but I'm preparing you for the Champions League. And it feels like it was a managerial success. And maybe from that, Ronaldo either learned a lesson, or maybe it was just that Zidane could get through to him, and that maybe now in Turin they can get through to him as well, that this is good for you as well. Even though there was once a time when you took him off for 10 minutes and he wasn't going to accept it, because that's 10 minutes where he could be scoring another goal.
Yeah, and I think that's really interesting, because I remember that happening in Zidane. And I think that if I remember correctly, like a lot of the story that was told around that was, here's Zidane, the one man who can talk to Ronaldo about this. Here's someone who can say, I've done this and you'll get it. Whereas Maurizio Sarri has none of that. Maurizio Sarri is the banker who came up through non-league football. And that was genuinely a thing that has been talked about a lot at Juventus. Like, does he have the strength of personality to carry a team that needs to win everything? And I think, yeah, there's a few signs, without wanting to jump the gun, because of course they could lose to Milan tonight and it could all turn, but that Sarri is in a slightly different place post lockdown to where they were before, I think.
You want to talk about Paolo Dybala, and he scored another lovely goal, and it still blows my mind that they almost sold him, or they even considered selling him at the start of this season.
Yeah, well, I mean, I will say that, to be honest with you, Juventus's financial plan remains something of a mystery to me. Ronaldo has obviously been great for raising the international brand, and that's important. And same you could say for signing Matthias De Ligt, but they are spending money pretty aggressively at the moment. Obviously, the Arthur Miralem Pjanic swap deal is some very creative accounting that allows both teams to make the bank balances look better with the amortization of those players. Dybala was, you know, the reason for selling him was because they needed to bring some money in. Mm-hmm. It's been really interesting to hear Sarri talking about Dybala in the last few days. And Dybala has been absolutely on fire since the league started up again, at least. I mean, of course, Juventus did lose the cup final before the league started up again. But he's playing so well. And what Sarri said was basically, I think I finally managed to convince him that he doesn't need to track back so much, that he should play closer to Ronaldo, that he should be there supporting him. And I think that's interesting on a few levels. First of all, because when it comes back to what Sid was talking about with Messi, like I think even these sort of world's greatest players that we're talking about, they give you their best when they are properly supported. For Ronaldo, I always think about Benzema and the work he did in Madrid, and Sid's, you know, already covered with Messi, how he was better suited perhaps to having or able to be more effective when Neymar was there. And I think that putting Dybala in places where he supports Ronaldo makes a ton of sense. Now, there's also a level on which it doesn't make sense, because you think, Christ, Sarri's whole thing at Napoli was that this team was going to run hard, be fast, counterattack quickly. And the question with Ronaldo has always been, God, can you carry a player who's not going to do that, who's going to hang around and who's going to be a bit more of a player on his own and is just there to contribute what he contributes going forward? And if you add Dybala to, listen, don't track back too much, don't worry about defending so much, you've now got nine players who have to do a lot of work for them. But the The reverse of that is Manu Tuosaari was brought to Juventus not just because they thought he was a good manager. It was specifically because the last few years under Allegri, the team was a bit boring. Like, it wasn't sort of the great sell, I guess, they were looking for at Juventus. Look, we're going to be one of the best teams in the world and play attractive football. And the football the last few games has been beautiful. They've played some really good stuff. They've scored some brilliant goals. And that's maybe what you get by giving Dybala license to play like that. Whether it will work, again, they've got Milan coming up tonight and they've got Atalanta at the end of the week. Well, hopefully it'll be a fantastic game against Atalanta because we know they're going to play attacking football as well.
And, you know, this weekend, Inter threw it away against Bologna, didn't they? And Lazio got hammered by Milan.
Yeah, I mean, two sort of very different stories. Lazio, of course, were 4 points back before the weekend, so still very much in the title conversation at that point. I think I find it quite sad in some ways what's happened with Lazio, just because I'm sure I talked about it on the podcast before, that time when the league was interrupted. They're the one team in Serie A history that, well, there were other teams that season, but the one season that's been suspended without completion in the history of Italian football was in 1915 with the war, and Lazio were headed towards the national final. And in fairness, they probably would have lost because teams in the north always won back then, but they felt like they were denied a shot at the title. This time it happens again. The league gets suspended. They're 1 point away at the time when the league gets suspended. They think they had their shot. So now, okay, the games are back and they're not going to be denied the chance to fight for the title, but they're in such a different place to where they were before the interruption. They lost 3-0 to Milan. Lazio, before the pandemic, had lost no games at home. Their goal difference at home was in 14 games. I think it was plus 27. They were a brilliant team, especially at home, and they had this great advantage over Juventus in the title race because they were out of all the cups and they just were going to have league games and rest to prepare for everything. Against Milan, they looked out on their feet. They were missing Ciro Immobile and Felipe Caicedo through suspension. They had Lucas Leiva coming back into midfield, who hasn't played since February because he's had an ankle operation. They were in pieces, and Milan, conversely, were not doing well before the break, are playing well now, and they got battered. It wasn't anything sort of unlucky about it. They were swept off the pitch, and it's just really hard to imagine that specifically is how they would have lost the title before the interruption. Maybe they still wouldn't have won it, but losing 3-0 at home to Milan, that's just not what I think would have happened.
Nicky, to what do you owe this or attribute this fatigue and lethargy that you wrote about in your column that you're talking about now? Surely they should have come out of lockdown reinvigorated and fresh.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting how different teams have come out of lockdown, and I'm certain that will speak to a combination of the coaching of those teams, the individual players and the work they've put in during lockdown. There's like an obvious aspect to this, which is Lazio never had the resources of Juventus. Lazio were never, I mean, look at wage bills, and they're paying a fraction of the overall total wage bill that Juventus are, that they were never supposed to compete. So there's all sorts of things that went into them being where they were before the break. It does include, for as horrible as this word is, and as much as statisticians like to deny it, some sense of momentum to them, some sense of, you know, being, I don't know, in that moment of belief and optimism that they had that has been lost. I think across all the leagues, they've seen that there's been an increase in injuries, and Lazio have a thinner squad than Juventus, and there have been players picking up little niggles. Milinkovic-Savic picked up a niggle in this game. Correa, who's the only remaining fit striker, picked up a niggle in this game. And I think the Lazio has just been thinner squad, not prepared for this moment. Juventus, bear in mind, as I mentioned, did fail to win two cup games and lost the, you know, cup final on penalties before the league started. So they got really an extra week and a bit to be ready for this, which Lazio didn't get. Juventus have come back with four games against basically bad teams other than Bologna. I mean, all of the teams they've played other than Bologna are, I think, between 16th and 18th at the current moment in time. So Lazio came back in against Atalanta, who they actually went 2-0 up against, but then Atalanta just had the legs and won it at the end. So there has been quite a lot of circumstance working against Lazio, but some of it, you're right, is not necessarily as simple as you can just put a finger on it, because everyone is playing in the same conditions.
Important to point out, Bologna manager, and I didn't know that Mihailovic was there, was wearing a great hat. A little bit Peaky Blinders, but I sort of forgive him for wearing a Peaky Blinders hat.
It's very much his look now. Yeah. And you know, to touch on that, because they beat Inter, where Lazio did this thing of the last way I would have imagined them losing the title before the break. Inter, who were already 8 points back, so probably not going to win the league, but if there was ever a way for Inter to run up the white flag, to finally give in, they won their previous game against Brescia 6-0. Against Bologna, in the 61st minute, they're 1-0 up. Bologna are on 10 men, and Inter have a penalty. So this game is absolutely done, right? Inter have won this game. And from there, Lautaro misses the penalty. Gagliardini misses the follow-up. Gagliardini has a ridiculous miss kick inside his area that sets up Juara to make it 1-0, and they find a way to lose. Bastoni gets sent off for them. It was the most Inter way for things to go wrong, and that is a bit of indictment of Antonio Conte, whose whole shtick, like his whole thing when he came in, was we're not going to be crazy Inter anymore. He even banned them from playing the club anthem, which the chorus is "Crazy Inter," at the games, because that wasn't going to be who they are anymore.
They banned the club anthem. Was there a replacement put in place, and what are the lyrics to that?
There is, and I can't remember what it's called.
Oh, well, you can't just bring in a new... What, is it a song related to Inter at all?
Or
is
a new song that sings the chorus is, we're really serious now. We're definitely not going to make any mistakes. No, absolutely not.
This would be great. Just instead of being the actual anthem, it was just like Conte giving a lecture.
This reminds me of when Cambridge played Blackpool in the LDV Vans final in about 2003, I think. And the Blackpool, they were like, now it's time for the Blackpool anthem, right? And they have some song about tangerines, I don't know what it is, and they all sang it, and there were loads more Blackpool fans than Cambridge fans. It says, now it's time for the Cambridge anthem, right? And we were like, well, we haven't got an anthem, right? We play I've Got a Lovely Bunch of Coconuts after a victory, but we don't play it before the game, right? It's after victory we play I've Got a Lovely Bunch of Coconuts. And we were like, they can't play coconuts before the game because we'll definitely lose. Anyway, suddenly the lyrics and the tune starts for Labby Siffrey, Something Inside So Strong. And we're all looking at each other going, we're going, this isn't us. The Blackpool fans pissing themselves, laughing at us. We're going, this isn't our song, you know, however high I build those barriers or whatever that goes. Anyway, we got hammered 4-1 and deservedly so. Sid, in 1 minute, can you round up anything else interesting from La Liga in terms of the European race or relegation? And the same question to you in 1 minute, Nicky, by the way.
In 1 minute, very quickly, it looks like it, you know, we started and we said everything was up for grabs. It sort of now feels like everything is clear and it's not up for grabs. You've got Madrid and Barcelona top two. It looks like Sevilla and Atletico will get those two Champions League places, which was a quite significant doubt when we restarted. A little bit of doubts about the European places. I think Villarreal will get one of them and maybe Real Sociedad the other, but there's other teams in there. And then at the bottom, on the face of it, it doesn't feel like a big deal, but it really, really is. Espanyol are going down if they do not win at Barcelona on Wednesday night at their rivals' ground. They're going to go down, and they've been in the first division for 27 years. And they're one of those teams that you sort of don't, and forgive me for saying this, Espanyol fans, you sort of don't notice them. They don't feel like a really big deal, but it really is a big deal, them going down. They're a huge club with Chinese owners now who, obviously, when they arrived, they were talking about, we're going to compete with the very best, and now they're on their way down. Their season has been going on for more than a year, though, because they went into European competition in the qualifiers this time last year, and it's going to end with them going down.
Nicky?
A bit like in Spain, a lot of the stuff that seemed up in the air at the beginning seems a lot less so now. Juventus, obviously 7 points clear, and also Atalanta have opened up a huge margin. I think it's 12 points, maybe even more to Napoli and Roma. Napoli playing very well, though. The other big one is Ralf Rangnick is... It's the worst keep secret in Italian football is that Milan have been courting him, trying to bring him in. A slight, tiny bit of ambiguity at the moment because Stefano Pioli is doing such a good job about whether Rangnick is going to come on a 3-year deal, apparently, whether he's going to come in as manager or if he's going to sort of take a director of sport role over Pioli, or if there's going to be some sort of co-management at the beginning because Pioli has made it awkward by doing well, basically. So we'll see exactly what the shape of it is. But Rangnick on a 3-year deal coming into the club.
What would that mean for Paolo Maldini, Nicky? Because he's sporting director there at the moment, isn't he?
Yeah, and The short answer
is they couldn't possibly turf poor Paolo.
It's genuinely quite a sort of unhappy story for Maldini because he refused to come back to the club for a while, saying, I don't want to come along and just be an ambassador. I want to come in only if there's a serious project and I will get a serious role involved on the football side of things. And now it's like, well, Brian Ranić, who one way or another as manager or director of sport, is going to end up looking after that side of things. That is basically what everyone's talking about. You know, Maldini going back to some sort of more institutional role, if you want to be polite about it, or basically ambassadorial role. And the understanding at the moment is that he's sort of said, I'm going to have a think about it. But I wouldn't be at all surprised if after having a think about it, he says, sod off.
You can't have Maldini doing the lounges, can you? It's like... That's what Messi will be doing in 25 years. You're just turning up in an executive suite.
Handing over the Man of the Match awards.
Exactly. With kids going, did he used to play? Now, the German season's over. It was cup final at the weekend. Archie Rintuck, you'll notice, is not on the podcast. He's on holiday. But before he went on holiday on Sunday, I talked to him about that and the end of the season. And I probably began by asking him how he was or something like that. Here it is.
Very well, Max.
Great. How was the cup final? Bayern Munich won it.
They did. About a month ago, Bayern Munich played Bayer Leverkusen and won 4-2. And in a big turn up for the books, Bayern Munich played Bayer Leverkusen on Saturday and won 4-2. And the game, I was at the game a month ago at the Bayer Arena. It followed a bit of a similar pattern, except this time Leverkusen didn't score first. And Bayern showed their class, dominated for the first half. But from a Leverkusen perspective, they had chances. Kevin Folland, who came on at half-time, forgot to kick the ball after Moussa Diaby squared the ball through to him. He also couldn't quite get hold of it the second time as well, which is not what you need. And then goalkeeper Lukas Radetzky, bless him. I spoke to him last week ahead of the cup final, and he was saying how the game against Bayern last month was probably the worst he's played this season. He obviously didn't anticipate what was going to happen to him on Saturday as he somehow managed to throw the ball in. Albeit, I think I spoke to my dad about the goal, actually, and he said that it was almost as if there was a magnet attached to the ball, the way that Robert Lewandowski struck it, and it was just destined for goal.
I thought it was actually quite hard. It was quite hard considering the shot was straight. If he just stood motionless, right, I think that ball wouldn't have gone in. It would have hit him and bounced out.
Yeah, but given Lukas Radetzky's luck against Bayern, it would have probably hit him in the face and he would have still become some sort of internet meme of some sorts. But yeah, like you have to feel a bit sorry for him also because it's not... I don't... Like, he took the blame after the game. He was like, look, I undid all our good work that we were doing in the second half by conceding that third goal. And it's like, well, if your teammates took their chances, then you might actually be in the game. And if the rest of your teammates turned up for the first half as well, you'd have a chance. But can't downplay how good Bayern are because they just find a way through every single team they're playing since the lockdown, since this post-lockdown football that we've been having. 11 wins out of 11, averaging 3 goals per game. Robert Lewandowski scoring for fun, having a record-breaking season. And yeah, I know they've got to take a break before the Champions League, but even with a break, I'd still fancy them for that.
The way Lewandowski took his second as well was, I think you're allowed to use the word impudence, aren't you, for a dink like that?
That's the only time that word ever crops up in football, isn't
yeah.
it? Yeah. But he's been great, but it's usually around this point in the season with Lewandowski when he's banging in goals for fun on a domestic level that we go, yeah, but can he do it in the Champions League in the moments when it matters? And I guess that's the big question now, not just for Lewandowski, but for the rest of the squad as well, particularly because it looks like, despite the fact that they are playing so incredibly well as a unit, David Alaba could be leaving. And he's been so important at centre-back, and the switch that he made over from left back is not to be underestimated. I think he showed just how good a player he is this season. But Thiago as well, who's not been able to get into the starting lineup in recent weeks, he looks much more likely to be off than Alaba. With Liverpool mentioned in that, have to see what happens there. I don't have any direct intel on what's going to happen with that. But I think Bayern losing him in terms of squad depth would be a huge blow for them, and they need to do all they can to try and keep him.
For Liverpool fans who don't watch any German football at all, what should they expect from Thiago if he comes over?
He's one of the best, if not the best, passers of a football I've seen live. His technical ability is unreal. He's a joy to watch. I think hampered by injuries at certain points in his time at Bayern, underrated player because I don't think he plays as far forward as some of the other attacking players, but he's a joy. It's just a question of how well this partnership is working with Goretzka and Kimmich right now. But in the right side, he only adds to it. I remember one of the first goals he scored for Bayern was this, in fact, I think it was his very first, was this stunning bicycle kick away at Stuttgart in the final minutes. And like, that's the sort of wondrous technical ability he's capable of. I remember this screwball pass he managed on the half volley away at Hamburg, which laid up a late winner there a few years ago as well. And it's just these moments. I don't know why Philomena Kunk's Moments of Wonder has come to mind.
It's the natural place to go.
But right, that's what Thiago makes me think of. Stunning player, but somehow can't make it into this team right now.
She very, very rarely talks about the Bundesliga in her little sections on on screen wipe, does she? It's not a difficult. It's not an easy question to answer in a minute or two. But how would you describe this season in the Bundesliga? We haven't spoken to you since it finished.
I'd say it's still been a roller coaster. Even if Bayern Munich have won the Bundesliga for an eighth season in a row, you look at what happened with the Dietmar Hopp protests back in February, with the Fadenkreuz, the crosshairs that he was appearing in the stands, and Bayern stopping their 6-0 procession against Hoffenheim, for example. You look at the impact that Erling Haaland has made since arriving from RB Salzburg as well. And also, I think what was good to see was the way that players took a lead on the Black Lives Matter protests off their own back as well, and seeing the support that they got there. So I don't think there's a nice way to compare all of these things, because these things are very different in them of themselves as well. But, you know, we had the clown car that was Jürgen Klinsmann's Hertha Berlin rolling into town, and him having his diary published about what his thoughts were of all the players, how embarrassing that was. Heiko Herrlich, the Augsburg coach, admitting in his first press conference before Corona that he'd popped out the hotel to go and buy face cream and toothpaste, and then getting a suspension so he couldn't be on the touchline. It's had a lot to it this season. But yeah, like, lots of feel-good stories, like Union Berlin's first year in the Bundesliga. They've been an excellent addition as well. And Freiburg continuing to punch above their weight. To fallen giants, you look at Schalke, 16 games without a win, they ended the season. Still, David Wagner holds on. Their president, Clemens Tönnies, resigned after overwhelming pressure for him to step down because of an outbreak of corona in one of his factories, which led to 1,000 people getting infected. There's a lot to get through.
Well, you know what? The roller coaster analogy is perfect, because there's loads of ups and downs. There's loads of loop the loops. But then you end up in the same place where you started, which is Bayern winning the league. Right. It's ideal. Now, there's one game left, which is the relegation playoff. We are recording this on Sunday because you are going on holiday on Monday. By the time the pod goes out, we'll know the score. So I'd like you to give a very specific prediction, and then we'll either congratulate you or laugh at you on the pod on Tuesday.
It will finish.
Is that it?
Heidenheim won. Yeah. Werder Bremen won. And Werder Bremen will squeak through on away goals. Have to mention that the fact they're playing Heidenheim is something that shouldn't have really happened, because Hamburg had it in their own hands to spark a North Derby, the North Derby in Germany, had they beaten Sandhausen on the final day last week. They didn't. They lost 5-1 at home to Sandhausen. Dieter Hecking, the coach, who's a renowned Bundesliga coach, was sacked. And Hamburg stay in the second division for a third year running. One final thing. Heidenheim, when they went to Werder Bremen for the first leg of the playoff last week, I mean, the football didn't really make the headlines, but what did was the fact that Heidenheim brought a cowbell, and you could hear that ringing throughout the first half. That is one of my highlights of the season, not just of this last month.
And listeners are mainly interested, Archie, and obviously your private life. Is there anything you could tell us about this holiday, or is it, you know, what goes on tour stays on tour?
Just going off for a week with three mates to the northeast coast of Germany. That's it. Place called Rügen. I've seen the pictures. My mates have booked it. Looks very tidy. Yeah, I'm excited. I've got to do the 7 hours of driving. And considering the fact that I managed to enter a motorway here the wrong way recently, I haven't told all my mates yet that, but this is fine, it's fine. But yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Well, hopefully you drive safely and we at least speak to you again one day.
I hope so too,
I hope so. Cheers, Archie.
Cheers.
That was the chat I had with Archie on Sunday, and he did predict Werder Bremen and Heidenheim would be a 1-1 draw and Bremen would stay up. It ended up being a 2-2 draw, but to be fair to Archie, two of those goals were in the 95th and 98th minute or something, so he was pretty bang on. But yeah, Werder Bremen stay up, which, you know, a bit like you're talking about Espanyol, right, being in the La Liga for so long. Werder Bremen have been in the Bundesliga longer than anyone else, I think, so good for them on staying up. Barry, do you have exciting European news from elsewhere?
Well, does Scotland count? does Scotland count, particularly if the news isn't particularly exciting?
Well, Devco says, can there be a Fitbar Corner where you discuss the SPFL's fixture-generating computer? You know, the one that is so random it's made Rangers visit Aberdeen on day one for the second time in 3 years, as well as given Celtic the delay to the first Old Firm that they wanted. Hashtag random.
Well, the fixture generator was busy and the Scottish Premiership fixture list came out on Monday, despite no one being altogether certain who exactly is going to be in the Scottish Premiership next season. Hearts and Partick Thistle obviously are seeking to have their relegations from the Premiership and Championship overturned, or else they want compensation to the tune of £10 million in total. So if they were to get that compensation, the Scottish Professional Football League Chief Executive Neil Doncaster has said that the 42 member clubs will end up having to foot the bill. We're here to serve the interests of all member clubs, said Doncaster, apparently oblivious to the fact that the very fact they're in this mess is because they didn't serve the interests of all member clubs. And that's why Hearts and Partick Thistle feel so aggrieved and are... So following the Hearts and Partick Thistle had obviously taken legal action. And last week it was decided at a court of session hearing that their legal case would be heard by an independent arbitration panel. The worry now is that that panel won't arrive at its decision before the Premiership is due to start, which would obviously be rather a disaster, and the Premiership wouldn't be able to start until they reach their decision. The Hearts and Partick Thistle have both asked to see certain documents from the SPFL relating to that famous Dundee vote that sort of went missing and then was changed. And the Scottish Professional Football League have refused so far to give them this information they want. So it's still a mess. Clearly, we will deal with whatever eventualities arise, said Neil Doncaster. But considering the mess his body made of this whole thing to begin with, which has got them into the current mess or escalated into the current mess, you wouldn't really have much faith in him. And I suppose from one bleak and desolate European outpost to another, Zenit St. Petersburg won the Russian Premier League over the weekend. They beat third place FC Krasnodar 4-2 on Sunday. So they've won their sixth Premier League title with four games to spare. And games in Russia, a small amount of fans are allowed in. So there's, I think, stadiums are allowed to be 10% full. So in the race for Europe, Zenit obviously have qualified for the Champions League. But you could throw a blanket over the four teams behind them. So there's another automatic place, which there's another automatic Champions League spot, which Lokomotiv Moscow are currently in the box seat to get. And behind them, there's Krasnodar, FC Rostov, and CSKA Moscow. So you could throw a blanket over the three of them. Whoever comes third goes into the third qualifying round. And in Turkey, who remembers Alexander Sorloth?
Yeah, Palace. He could strike a ball, but he always hit it straight at the keeper, as far as I remember.
Yeah, well, he's not doing that in Turkey. He's still a Palace player, but he's on loan at Trabzonspor. And he scored his 29th goal in 44 games.
Wow.
As Trabzonspor beat Galatasaray 3-1 on Saturday. They're 2 points behind Medipol Başakşehir, who are on course to win their first ever title in Turkey.
Wow, tremendous amount of information you've just given
us. I'm very impressed as well that Baz not only delivered a lot of information, but proved Kylie Minogue to be a liar. Because she said the Lokomotiv was very easy. As easy as I proved it wasn't. I mean, her little baby sister can do it for free.
All right, that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll do a little bit of Jose and any other business. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Now, on July the 21st, you can get increasingly excited about the live stream show with me, Wilson, Lars and Barry in the corner. Not an official Guardian event, but £5 to sit in your house and watch us do a live show open to the whole of the globe. So here is where we find out if we're popular at all and exactly where we're popular.
As I said to you, Max, we could sell four tickets or 40,000. Please don't let it be four, listeners. Oh, please.
No. It's good that we
couldn't handle it.
Good we waited until lockdown doesn't really exist anywhere as well. So people can go outside. Anyway, more info to come very soon. Please, just, you know, even if you go out, just buy a ticket to make us not feel as bad about ourselves. Now, Spurs beat Everton 1-0.
You can still watch on your phone in the pub beer garden.
Exactly, you know. Right, yeah. Spurs beat Everton 1-0. Andrew says, when the world has ended and we are but dust, will the boredom of Spurs Everton still linger among the stars? Tom says, is there anything more Mourinho than Jose Mourinho winning the 200th game of his career with a 1-0 win at home, courtesy of an own goal? George says, yes, he's won trophies, but what is it that Jose actually does that seems to inevitably destroy the soul of a team technically, personally, and leaves a group of players empty? And James says, as an Arsenal fan, some of the fleeting joy I've gotten out of this season has been watching the Mourinho effect reach third season form in the first season at Spurs. Do you have a favourite Mourinho effect moment? Obviously, you know, he won stuff at Real Madrid and at Inter Milan, but did he have that effect, Sid?
Look, at Real Madrid, there's no doubt that he was there a season too far. I mean, from his own point of view as well, and I don't know if he's ever said this publicly, but I think that final season, you know, he'd already wanted to go. He'd already wanted to be out of there. And I mean, obviously, look, I don't want to focus it on Madrid because it may be totally unfair, but I sometimes felt like something of what happened at Madrid kind of broke things a bit. And I'm not going to say broke him because, I mean, you know, there's still a lot of things that he can offer and so on. But it sort of felt like it broke things and it did shift the balance from, as you say, from this kind of charismatic figure, even if you didn't like him, because obviously there are plenty of people who didn't like him when he was this charismatic figure, to being something that actually didn't really have that charisma anymore either. And you know, even taking away, as you say, Baz, that became nasty. But the funny thing at Real Madrid is towards the end, I wouldn't even necessarily call it nasty. It almost wasn't interesting enough to be nasty. It was just kind of bitter and absent, if you see what I mean.
Nikki?
I think that's really interesting because, because I wrote a piece early in lockdown about the treble-winning season at Inter. And of course, Inter's the one club where Mourinho didn't stay too long, right? He was there for two seasons. He won absolutely everything. You can certainly talk about the impact he has leaving a club because since he's left, you know, Inter, who had won three Serie A titles in a row before he came, haven't won any Serie A titles, let alone another Champions League. But when I was researching that, I was watching some of the sort of old press conferences he gave. And his first press conference, he's asked whether or not his kids and his wife are going to come to Milan. And he says, yes, you know, my kids are kids of the world. You know, they're international kids. They're used to it. And José without his family is not José. And actually, then we have this chapter in Manchester where he's living in a hotel and he seems like this sort of sad, lonely figure. I don't know if he actually was sad, and that could be entirely media narrative around it. But from the outside, he didn't look like someone who was enjoying life. And I think that thing of, is he himself having fun? Is he happy? I think that is at least some part of this recipe of, is he a charming, mischievous character, or is he just sort of a, I don't know, he seemed, like Baz said, that the Carnero incident really switched it into something much darker.
Mm. I hope that somebody at the next press conference says, you know, enough on Serge Aurier's calf strain. José, are you happy?
In all seriousness, a question along those lines, even if you frame it in footballing terms, would be very interesting to hear from Mourinho. And I sort of do feel like he would probably respond to that as well, because obviously a lot of it is about how he feels with how things are going around him, normally as a way of if you like, deflecting blame or shifting the attack elsewhere. But I think a question along the lines of, José, are you happy with, even if it's happy with how things are going rather than, yeah, but are you happy? I think there's mileage in someone asking him that.
No, Nicky, you make a very fair point. It will, your happiness will dictate how well you do in your, you know, how you do professionally, whatever it is. And I think it's worth remembering that. Despite the fact, I also think I quite like someone to facetiously ask José if he was happy, as well as seriously asking if he was happy. We should congratulate Oxford and Wickham for getting to the League One playoff final, of which the best question we got was from George. Based on his necklace, how good do you reckon Gareth Ainsworth is at surfing? which I really enjoyed. And finally, this from Wakefield Neil. On the subject of that Forest fan who jumped in the canal when he thought Forest had beaten Derby, but they hadn't. He said, as a Forest fan of nearly 50 years, we could be 10-0 up against Barcelona in a Champions League final and somebody could offer me £1 million on top and I still wouldn't go anywhere near the waterways of my fair city. Pure filth, he says. And that'll do for today. Nicky, thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you, Sid. Cheers, Baz.
Thanks.
We'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.